I'm Thea Card with a check of the KDLG local news. The Department of Health and Social Services informs C-Care Services in Anchorage, a personal care and home-based waiver service provider, that all Medicaid payments for services as a Medicaid provider are temporarily suspended. The announcement is based on a credible allegation of fraud for which an investigation is pending with the Alaska Department of Law Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. Just about every gubernatorial mayor candidate since Jay Hammond has made advancing a gas line part of their platform. This election is no different. With early field work being done on a project, Republican Governor Sean Parnell and unaffiliated candidate Bill Walker are sparring over who can negotiate the best deal and who can close it. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
How much money do you have to spend to get a handful of dirt? About $500 million if you're talking about samples from the proposed site for a natural gas liquefaction plant in Nikiskie.
So dirt's what you sweep under the rug.
Dick Rains is a geotechnical engineer for Exxon, and he's collecting soil samples to make sure the land is stable enough for a massive construction project.
Yeah, we have a drill bit down there, and we drill out, and then we pull that out and we put on these samplers and we pound them into the ground.
A member of his team shows off the gravel to a scrum of reporters who have been flown down to see people actually working in the field. The deal to get to this point in a gas line project was inked this past year by the state of Alaska, Exxon, BP, Conoco, and TransCanada, and plenty of effort has already gone into permitting and export licensing. But the early engineering work that started this summer was really the first to involve boots on the ground. The scene itself isn't very impressive. A small mobile drill rig to extract the soil, about half a dozen men in safety gear. But all the Alaska LNG employees accompanying reporters to the site are quick to emphasize that the project itself is unprecedented in scope.
Nobody's ever permitted a project like this before. There's never been a project this large done in the U.S.
Steve Butt is a project manager for Alaska LNG. He says even the numbers for the preliminary work match the ambition of a project that involves one gas treatment plant, one liquefaction plant, and 800 miles of pipeline.
You're investing $2+ billion to see if it makes sense to invest another $45 to $65 billion.
Now there's the question of whether the project will get to that point. Just as summer field work is winding down, the gas line is coming up as a political issue.
Bill Walker wants to renegotiate the deal, which will add years of delays. Let's stick with the gas line project that's working, and the governor who's making it happen, Sean Parnell.
Incumbent Republican Sean Parnell is now airing ads promoting his own work on the project and criticizing his unaffiliated opponent. Parnell campaign manager Tom Wright notes that Walker has made statements about the gas line that suggest he would try to change the project.
At one point he called the gas line fatally flawed, and now he's saying, well, we might continue the work of what the governor's doing. We just don't know where he's coming from. And
Walker has campaigned heavily on the issue of a gas line in the past, and he's been an advocate for a project in which Alaska has a greater stake. Right now, Exxon, BP, and Conoco control 75% of the project, and Alaska splits its share with TransCanada, with the option of buying some of it back down the road. Walker now says he's willing to operate within the framework established by lawmakers this past year, but that doesn't necessarily mean he won't try to affect the terms of the deal going forward, depending on what those confidential terms are.
I will finish the project. I will not start over. I have no particular issues with the route. I've said that Nikiski is fine. I don't have an issue with that. But I do have an issue with the ultimate decision making being made by somebody other than Alaska.
While the gas line has been a flashpoint for the two candidates, with Walker even suggesting they hold an hour-long debate just on that issue, gas line experts say companies tend to be more comfortable with an incumbent, even if the two candidates share the same view on a project. Larry Persily, the federal coordinator for an Alaska natural gas project, says that's simply because they know what to expect from a person with whom they've already negotiated.
The oil and gas industry, any business, particularly one that's looking at spending tens of billions of dollars, gets a little nervous when there's political change.
For their part, the oil companies are being politic about the governor's race. Back in Nikiski, Walker and Parnell signs both dot the roadside, leaving the LNG site. Project manager Steve Butt says he's been asked pretty often about how much the governor's race will affect the natural gas project.
It's a fair question, I understand it, but the project is measured in decades, and there's going to be lots of political transitions. As long as all the owners can continue to work in that spirit, you know, we can find a way to make it work.
So far, none of the companies involved in the project have put money behind either candidate. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
U.S. Senate candidate Dan Sullivan received the endorsement of Tea Party Express, the nation's largest Tea Party political action committee. The PAC created a statewide radio ad featuring former Republican Senate nominee Joe Miller. Although Tea Party Express was a major supporter of Joe Miller in 2010, the group says Miller and Sullivan agree on the importance of defeating liberal Senator Mark Begich. The Chilista Corporation's board of directors approved the first ever Acalista Fund dividend with a total distribution of $1.62 million. Chilista has 12,900 shareholders and is one of the largest of the Alaska Native corporations. The Chilista region includes more than 6.5 million acres and 56 villages, which have been incorporated into 46 individual village corporations. Currently, the total of shares for Chilista is over $6 million. Communications manager for the Chilista Corporation, Tom Leonard, says although the group has provided 9 dividends to its shareholders, the Acalista Fund is different.
What's different about the Acalista Fund dividend is this is the first dividend from this investment fund.
He says 20 years ago, Chilista set up an investment account to be available to be able to save money when it grows. That way, the group could avoid significant financial dips that happen naturally in businesses.
What Chilista's board of directors really wanted to do was have something that was more stable for our shareholders in perpetuity.
The Acalista Fund dividend distribution equates to $1.22 per share. Leonard says this dividend is a lot like the state's PDF.
The Acalista Fund was set up as a separate account, if you will. It's an investment fund. The Acalista Fund also has investments in the market. Through targeted investments in a broad range of industries, the board and management have established a pretty stable and so far solidly performing market account for our shareholders.
Meanwhile, Chilista Corporation is set to begin public outreach in regards to a resolution that will be going in front of shareholders in 2015. This resolution would decide whether or not the organization wants to enroll descendants as shareholders. Only original shareholders or those who are gifted the original shares are allowed to own them. This resolution would allow people like Leonard's children to qualify for shares.
And so until our next annual meeting next summer, we're going to be out presenting information about what the effects would be about enrolling descendants. So this is based on shareholder feedback that they would like to see. And now we're going to spend the next 8 months or so providing that information to shareholders.
Chilista will be looking at the impact of adding descendants and how much that will affect the payout. Checks from the Acalista Fund dividend are expected to be mailed by Friday, November 15th. Concerns about Ebola are running high in Unalaska. The town's unique geography and large international workforce have residents wondering how they'd be affected by an outbreak. As KUCB's Anna Ropeek reports, local medical providers are trying to calm those fears.
Unalaskans have been seeking reassurance about Ebola anywhere they can find it, from the local clinic to the mayor's office. After weeks of fielding nervous phone calls, the city decided to make their emergency plans clear and remind residents that their risk of contracting Ebola is still pretty low. It's rare to see more than a handful of people turn out for a public meeting in Unalaska, but at Tuesday night's panel on Ebola preparedness, more than 75 people packed into City Hall. The standing room only crowd wanted answers to questions like this.
So somebody says, walk through exactly what the process would be if Ebola hit here now.
That's Ann Nora Arrett, the medical director at the local clinic.
Let's say somebody called up one of the processing safety officers and said, I have a fever and vomiting and diarrhea. Okay, so EMS gets called and you take it from there.
Senior Fire Captain Zach Chastain stepped in to answer for the city's emergency medical volunteers.
As it stands right now, if we had a call tonight, we could respond appropriately to it.
He said dispatchers would ask the caller about their symptoms and recent travel to try to assess the risk of Ebola. Paramedics would try to confirm that on scene by looking for a fever above 101.5 degrees. If they found one, responders would put on their full-body hazmat suits. Chastain says they have gear and training in line with the latest Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines. He says responders would help get the patient into quarantine at the clinic, where a trained staff member would try to rule out other illnesses. But in the end, Arrett says the patient would have to be flown off the island for an official diagnosis. The clinic's game plan is the result of conversations with state and federal health officials, Arrett said. The Coast Guard, commercial medevac companies, and the local tribal clinic have also been consulted. As plans move forward, Arrett asked residents to be conscious of the stigma surrounding Ebola.
We don't want to make assumptions about someone's skin color and label them with being a carrier of infection. So please keep that in mind. And we'll be doing some educational sessions, hopefully, in some of the bigger plants where they have a lot of people coming in together in a small area.
She said she's been keeping up with local processing companies on how they're screening returning workers for signs of illness or risky travel. Some, like Westward and Alyeska Seafoods, conduct physical examinations as they recruit for the next big processing season in January. Meanwhile, Unalaska's biggest processor, Unisea, is screening workers based on travel, too. But their human resources director says they don't typically recruit workers from West Africa, where the outbreak is centered right now. Then there's American Seafoods, which runs offshore processing operations in Unalaska. Arrett said they've asked employees who've been to an affected area to stay home for 30 days before coming to work.
I know they're doing screening in Seattle, and then they plan on also doing screening in Dutch Harbor.
Even if the risk of Ebola is low in Unalaska, Arrett said folks should make sure they're staying healthy in other ways.
If you choose to get a flu shot, this would be a good year to get a flu shot.
And she said people should do their best to prevent the spread of illness. For its part, the clinic's taking no chances. A sign posted on the front door last week tells patients with Ebola-like symptoms to stop outside and call for an escort into the building. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Roper.
It could take weeks for a specialized part to be ordered and shipped to Petersburg, a small town in southeast Alaska. But what if you could just make the part at home? That's the idea behind 3D printers. And students at Petersburg High School are busy learning and teaching others about how that technology works.
That's Petersburg High School senior Skipper Erickson playing a euphonium. But he's not using a traditional mouthpiece. This one he made himself using a computer and a 3D printer.
One of my friends has a plastic mouthpiece that he bought, and since we have a 3D printer, I thought it'd be a good project to make.
The high school got the 3D printer in 2013 and another one this spring. Erickson uses them in a class called MacTech. The printers basically create 3D objects out of melted plastic and a blueprint on a computer. The actual process of making the mouthpiece didn't take that long.
I had to edit the design a little bit. That took about 20 minutes. And then printing, I think, took 2.5 hours.
The process is obviously not like your average office printer. The 3D printer uses a spool of plastic cord that is fed into a melting piece, kind of like a hot glue gun. Then it slowly, layer by layer, builds a very precise object. The euphonium mouthpiece had 476 layers. Using this technology, Erickson thinks he might be able to get an edge up on his physics project, making rockets.
And I was thinking about designing some fins and nose caps to make the rockets fly a little farther so they'd be accurate and strong because of the plastic.
Versus what would the other option be?
The other options would be just cutting up plastic bottles to make fins and cardboard.
So this would be more precision-oriented?
Yeah. It'd be more precise and it'd work better.
Erickson may not be your average student, but you don't have to be the head of your class to use a 3D printer. Students don't have to design a project from scratch. There's actually a website that has 3D models that students use.
All right, so we have a GoPro tripod mount that we want to 3D print.
at a meeting of the Petersburg School Board, high school students Tucker Hagerman and A.J. Erickson, no relation to Skipper, are helping to explain to the adults in the room how it all works. They stand next to a table with a 3D printer and a laptop. The computer screen is projected onto the wall, showing a documentary they made about the process.
Since we have SketchUp, we can customize this object. So we're going to end up putting some text right here on this face, I think. Now we're going to cut to a sped up video of our printer printing our project here.
After the video, the teenagers pass around examples of objects that they made in school. There's a red Lego piece, a black hard drive case, and a green GoPro mount. The teens are convinced that future applications are endless.
Now where this can tie to school is...
A.J. Erickson explains how the school could save money by printing these little gadgets that prevent computer cords from breaking.
So that'll last a little longer and you'd save $50 a month on ordering new chargers.
The plastic cord's not too expensive at 7 cents a gram. The euphonium mouthpiece used about $1.26 worth. Of course, the printer itself costs more at $1,300. How cost-effective the 3D printer is may be unknown at this point, but one thing is for sure. These high school students are leading the way. And in the meantime, Skipper Erickson will continue to use his new mouthpiece. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
A handful of University of Alaska Fairbanks students recently created 38 all-UPIC learning books for use in the lower Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. KYUK's Charles Enoch has this story.
That is the sound of students learning at the Ayapunlitnarvik School in Bethel. They're using books recently released from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The books are called Bijereyaramta Lijungjelcha, or in English, Teaching Our Way of Life. UAF Professor Teresa John presented the books at the Association of Village Council Presidents Convention in Bethel earlier this month. She says these days Yupik is making a comeback as a result of such projects, and that she loves seeing the youth speak Yupik in the mainstream.
I'm very grateful when I hear kids talk about what they're learning in Yupik. I also find it really cute these days when little kids text in Yupik or even comment in our language on Facebook.
The project was started in 2009 with a grant that was awarded by the United States Department of Education. A group of UAF students who were Yupik teachers were asked by UAF to look at their materials and decide which subjects fell short in Yupik. UAF Associate Professor of Linguistics and Foreign Languages, Sabine Ziegman, says the students identified three themes.
We identified ceremonies and celebrations, traditional games and toys, and survival as really important themes. And the teachers then went out to interview elders.
Ziegman was the principal investigator for the grant. She says the teachers then compiled the knowledge and separated the information into different grade levels. The three-year project ended last year, resulting in a set of 38 Yupik learning books for students from kindergarten to sixth grade. Bethel resident Carol Olton was a part of the project. She is also a second grade teacher at the Yupik Immersion School in Bethel. She says books like these will be useful in a place like Bethel, where Yupik isn't very common in the younger generation. Though there is a resurgence in Yupik speakers, it is still nowhere near the common language it once was in the area.
It seems like less and less students come in to learn Yupik. There were more back in the day when people were moving to Bethel. I hope books like these will give kids incentive to learn Yupik early on.
The project was made possible through a grant that was awarded in 2009 to the partnership of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, the Lower Kuskokwim School District, and the Lower Yukon School District. The books are in the Central Yupik dialect, but can be adapted to other dialects and are available as e-books through the UAF website. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Many of the stories you hear during the KDLG local news can be found online at www.kdlg.org. You can also find contact information on the website if you'd like to provide a comment, correction, or news tip. That's a check of the KDLG local news. In Dillingham, I'm Thea Card reporting.